I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about what it means to be white. We're going to talk about white privilege, white fragility, and white presumption. We will discuss the ongoing and deep impact of race in America and in the world. My guests are Robin DiAngelo, an author, consultant, and lecturer on racial and social injustice, and the Reverend Anastasia Zinke of All Souls Unitarian Church. Please join this important conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about what it means to be white in America, and some degree also what it means to be white in the world. If you want to join this conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Robin DiAngelo. She is an author, consultant, and lecturer on racial and social injustice, and the Reverend Anastasia Zinke, All Souls Unitarian Church. It's going to be hosting a seminar featuring Robin DiAngelo this Saturday. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. Well, I'm going to start first by talking a little bit about, let's talk about the ways that it makes a difference to be white in this culture. Robin, I will start with you.
To be white, to be raised as white in a society that is deeply separate and unequal by race makes a profound difference. If we were not in a society that was deeply separate and unequal, it may not make a difference. But that is the reality that we're born into and raised into. And to be white is to be raised without really a sense of oneself as a racial being. Right. So I certainly had a sense of somebody having race, but not really myself. And all of those dynamics have consequences for the way we interact across race and for the ways in which this inequality that I've mentioned keeps being reproduced and reinforced.
Yeah, that point has always fascinated me because most people, you know, white European Caucasians, if you ask them, and, you know, I probably, since this is radio, I'm assuming most people will get this from the get-go. I am, in fact, a white Caucasian myself. You know, at least the point you make about there being almost an absence of racial consciousness. If I think of myself, I think of myself as, you know, of German, Scotch-Irish heritage. I don't think of the whole idea that I'm white as part of a race, whereas for almost anyone else in this country, that's an omnipresent concern. What does that do to the discussion, to our presumptions about race in this country?
Well, there's much that proceeds from that. So one, the sense of ourselves as individuals, you know, and because of the things that we've just talked about, really getting to be an individual is something that only is granted to us, right? I'm just Robin, but people of color are generally, I think about Robert Altman is a film director, Spike Lee will always be a black film director. And so we assume that everybody is granted individualism, even as we, of course, continually see people of color in racial terms. And so seeing ourselves as individuals also reinforces this idea that we're unique, that we can be exempt from the forces of socialization. And so it also has us resisting grappling with, yes, I'm Robin and I've had this specific life trajectory that may be different from others, but I'm also a member of a group that has profound significance. And I need to be willing to grapple with that significance. But the way that we're raised to see ourselves sets us up to actually reject that grappling, which then holds our very limited understandings in place. And we bring that limited understanding to the table when we try to talk across race. And we're very frustrating for people of color for the most part because of that. When you add ignorance, right, because we're not given good information, with arrogance, it makes this very difficult.
You have the beginnings of a political career there, but that's a whole nother story. Anastasia, why did All Souls decide this was the subject, and why this was the time to have this kind of discussion?
Well, All Souls Unitarian Church has been engaging in this year of learning around how to really unpack terms such as diversity, multiculturalism, identity, anti-racism. And this is kind of the finale of that year of learning. And one of the things that we discovered and knew early on is that there's a lot to learn when it comes to understanding culture, identity, multiculturalism. And that many of us had not dived deep into that material. And so, one of the things that there used to be an assessment tool called the Intercultural Developmental Inventory, and I think it changed its name. But one of the things that we discovered in that is that Unitarian Universalists in our congregation fall where most Americans fall, which is in this stage called minimization. So, I know that. Kind of, I was raised to say, oh, it's not polite to kind of notice differences or name differences in people and their cultures and kind of like point that out. And so that's sort of become the normative mode. The interesting thing is when you try to ignore culture or identity or ethnicity, then you really don't pay attention to some of the important differences in lived experiences. So the thing that we got most cognitive of is how important it is to know ourselves. And so to know ourselves, we have to say, what does it mean to be white? What does that term even evoke? It doesn't come associated with a certain location. It doesn't seem to have a music of its own. It doesn't have a cuisine of its own, but we all use this term. And so part of what we're trying to do, and bring Robin in is to understand how do we come about to use this term white so freely when we have so little understanding of it, and by becoming consciously aware of it to help increase our abilities to understand ourselves and how we function in the world, and to begin to be more conscious of how we dialogue with people who might have very different lived experiences.
We are talking today on No Limits about what it means to be white in America. If you want to join this conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Brian has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. I
Hi.
think it's a very important topic you're going over right now, and I just had a couple experiences, if you'd like, I'd like to share with you.
Sure.
Living in Indianapolis for a few years now, we had a neighbor had teenage sons and discussing an event that they were heading to, said they were waiting for another car to show up. And well, why can't you just all fit in the same car? He explained to me as a black teenager, if they ride four people to a car, that they would get pulled over. And I found that, disheartening. I've lived in LA for 8 years and seen very much the difference as a white man, the difference in the way that I get treated, whether it be professional or personal, business at a fast food joint or so. When I got pulled over by police for speeding or running a red light, which didn't happen, but when I got pulled over before, it was license registration. Here you go. Here's your ticket. Go away. But very often you would see people of color the side of the road, pockets pulled out, contents of their pocket on the hood of the car, hands on the hood of the car while the police did his business in the car while the other one watched him from the shoulder. And when the riots broke out in Los Angeles, I lived there, watched many of the fires burn from my window. And afterwards, a gentleman I played softball with told me many stories about this is how black people get treated in Los Angeles as compared to what the white man privilege and the legacy that that entails. I find it that this program and the conversation you're having may do some more to help understand the cultural differences, and that the sooner that people realize that their place is legacy granted as a white person or as a cultural misunderstanding as a person of color, maybe we can come closer together and solve some of those problems. Unfortunately, the stories I had to do with the police officers, but some of that is because I don't believe that they understand the culture as it is, or as much as it is. There's a fear, as you know, been demonstrated with the social media and the shootings that have been happened that seem to go very fast to that. So any comments or reaction to that, I'd be happy to take off air.
Thanks very much for the call, Brian. Take care.
Thank you, John.
Robin, those are not uncommon stories, right?
Yeah, I have some thoughts that connect to both the caller's point and something that Anastasia raised, which is, one, not knowing what it means to be white, not being able to engage with any complexity or nuance in that question, right? Tending to respond with the most simplistic responses. It's not actually benign, right? It actually functions quite powerfully to hold the current racial hierarchy in place. So that's really key. And also, we so rarely see how other people are treated. Segregation is probably the most powerful tool of kind of post-civil rights racism, why we keep getting the same inequitable outcomes despite, you know, each individual white person, for the most part, seeing themselves as colorblind and open-minded and all of these things, is we actually don't know what's going on for people of color and what their experiences are. And to project our own, right? Well, the police have always treated me well, so of course they would treat you well, and therefore you must be exaggerating your experience. And in that way, we continually invalidate, when we do have that rare opportunity to see the world through someone else's lenses, we unfortunately tend to reject those lenses. So, and I really appreciate the humility of the caller.
Is that one? Go ahead, Anastasia.
Oh, and I was going to say, too, I think it's wonderful to understand the experiences of people who don't share your background or your identities. But I also think it's really important for us to recognize that as white people moving in the world, that we actually have lots of experiences that can be unpacked. So a couple weekends ago, we had an African-American Unitarian Universalist woman come in who'd helped us kind of unpack multiculturalism. And she pointed out for every marginalized identity, there's a corresponding privileged identity. So Brian talked really wonderfully and meaningfully about how Black people are viewed with fear and hostility. And I know every time that I show up at a security door and they see my little picture, I smile at them. And I'm very aware in those moments, I'm a fairly young, white female. And if I'm holding my daughter, I smile at them. And I know, I'm like, I look saved, honest, and trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And I had never have a fear that I'm going to get a question about, oh, why are you here or who you're going to meet? They'll open the door for me. And that's always been my experience.
Well, and the signal is you belong there. And the corresponding signal is to somebody else is maybe you don't belong.
That's there. Right. And so I think the question is always to ask, why have I been told already without meeting me that I'm trustworthy and good?
And that presumption. We probably ought to, before we get too far into this conversation, talk about the event on Saturday real quickly and how people can attend if they wish to be part of the conversation. Anastasia.
If you go to eventbrite.com and search Robin DiAngelo, you will find the link here in Indianapolis, and tickets are available to purchase online for $50.
So it's $50. How long does the event run?
9 to 4.
9 to 4, so it's all day, and it's at All Souls?
Unitarian Church, which is on East 56th Street between Emerson and Arlington.
Okay, and in addition, I'm assuming you're not going to make poor Robin talk for the entire 7 hours. That there are other things going on besides Robin's talk.
There are breaks and a lunch break as well for people to go out and have some lunch and do a little reflection and to give Robin a break as well.
And Robin,
there are a lot of opportunities for people to turn and talk, for small group discussions, for reflection. So it will be interactive in that way.
Okay. So the event then is this Saturday from 9 to 4. It's $50, and it's at All Souls, which is on East 56th Street here in Indianapolis. If you are just joining us, we are talking about what it means to be white in America today. We're going to be talking more about the questions of white privilege, white fragility, and white presumption when we come back from the break. My guests are Robin DiAngelo. She's an author, consultant, and lecturer on racial and social injustice, and the Reverend Anastasia Zinke of All Souls Unitarian Church. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about what it means to be white in America today in anticipation of a discussion, a community conversation at All Souls Unitarian Church this Saturday from 9 to 4. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Robin DiAngelo, who is going to be central to that discussion on Saturday. She's an author, consultant, and lecturer on racial and social injustice, and the Reverend Anastasia Zinke of All Souls Unitarian Church. Got an email comment question from our regular listener, Jerry. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, I've never been black or female or gay, but I've been poor, and that was bad enough. Poor as we were, my poor white family was not nearly as poor as the average African-American family. How do we as a nation address the problem of wealth inequality? Robin, I'll throw that one to you first.
Well, that's such a huge question. I'm actually not going to address the problem of wealth inequality, but what I really want to appreciate is this writer's acknowledging that growing up poor did not exempt him or her from the impact of also growing up white. And mm-hmm. that's a really hard place for a lot of white people. If they experience a form of oppression somewhere else, then they assume that they couldn't possibly have privilege in another access. And these things, you know, intersect in really complex ways. I also grew up in poverty, and it was whole periods of homelessness, foster care, a very deep sense of shame throughout my childhood. And yet I always knew I was white. And in so many ways, that whiteness helped me navigate poverty, sexism as a female, and be where I am today. It's simply not the same experience. I don't have any less racism. I haven't been socialized to have any less racism than a middle-class white person. I just learned it from a different class location. And that's one of the challenges for us, again, as white people, is not to find places to exempt ourselves, but to always ask, okay, so how did that particular situation set me up to collude with the overall system of racism?
Well, and this is one of the things, because I think it speaks to the seeming intractability of this problem. I wouldn't necessarily say I grew up in poverty, but I was born in, you know, in subsidized housing in Cleveland. But that's not necessarily a presumption anyone who knows me now would make about my background. It's easier for me to shed identities or to assume new ones, in part because people, you know, because there isn't this sort of, even struggling to find a language here, a vocabulary to speak of this, that the immutability of race, I guess. There just seems to be so much more mobility associated with being of European, Western European descent in this country and culture than it is for any place else. What is the impact of that on our culture and our society? I'd like to hear both of your thoughts. I think I'll start with Anastasia first, but then I want to hear Robin.
Robin's comment reminded me of a memory that I had. I grew up in New York City, and I, for a summer, attended the Harlan School of the Arts. And I grew up basically being raised in a home alone with my mother, who was mentally ill and unemployed for decades. And so we were poor, and we got a a scholarship to go to the Harlan School of the Arts. And of the 300 or so scholar artists there, I was the only white person that I ever saw. And it was really interesting because I was there, and there was this one day we were in our choral class, and someone who played a band instrument and needed a chair without a desk component came in, and the desk component chairs were the popular chairs, or the ones without one were the more popular chairs, and he said, "I really need this chair. I can't play without it." And we kind of paused, and I said, "All right, he could have my chair." And the teacher, who was African-American, in front of this class said, "Look at Anastasia. She is such a good person. Look how she helped others. All of you should try to be more like her." Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to sink in myself and go, oh my God, how can you use me as an example of what goodness and generosity looks like in this context? And it just reminds me that, you know, even when I was poor, and struggling and with all my family issues, I could still be used as a representative of what it means to be, you know, again, kind-hearted and pure and good. And I think that what we have to understand is that no matter what our class location is, and those are really serious problems that deserve many radio shows, that racial dynamic still often divides us and gets used to divide us in ways that prevent us from really working together to try to improve conditions for the average person.
Robin.
You know, the question that guides me, because some of these issues, I mean, separating out nature from nurture, true versus false, is really, really difficult. And so I always ask, how does it function? And in thinking about class and how it often will come up in a conversation about race, that's the question I ask, right? How does it function to move to class in this conversation? And generally what it does is take race off the table and then move us into this big, huge other discussion. You know, to use it to say, well, so then how do class and race function together? That's a different use of it, right? And so, you know, in this work, and I think Anastasia can probably relate, and I realize that I did not identify myself, so I just want to be really clear, I am white. It's really incredibly, it's a breakthrough if you can get white people to acknowledge that they have automatic unearned advantage as a result of being white. That does not mean we don't have struggles or experience other kinds of oppressions, but we are not struggling in this really, really deep, huge, fundamental form of oppression. We are, in fact, benefiting from it. And so if you could get white people to acknowledge that, that's like huge. But even that often becomes superficial. And people just say, oh, well, yes, here's a list of privileges. And then they carry on, you know, having kind of done the, you know, proper progressive thing. And none of their patterns actually change. None of the ways that they interact across race have changed at all. And so the next level of question you want to ask is, and so how did those experiences that all these folks that have shared and that Anastasia just shared an example of, how do they function in the way that I come to the table, right? How do they actually shape my consciousness, my identities, and what patterns have resulted from them? Because otherwise, it's just kind of an empty exercise to list privilege. Does that make sense to you, Anastasia?
We are talking about what it means to be white in America today. I can see our phone banks have filled up. So I'm going to start taking calls now, and I'm going to ask the people who join the conversation to be succinct in their questions. Again, if you want to call in, the number is 866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be on your program as usual. And once again, you have a great program going.
Thanks. What's on your mind?
I'll be succinct. I'd like to know what the ladies believe information access has to do with the situation at hand. My commentary on that idea is that whites have access to information almost as a given right, whereas most other minorities or different races have to dig, look for, and discover that information. And I'll use the current student loan situation, where many blacks are falling into the trap of the for-profit educational institutions, whereas whites already have the information. They go back generations of knowing how to get money to go to school. And that's just one example. I'd like to know what the ladies think about that.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Robin, I'll throw that one to you first.
Well, I'm thinking, and also those for-profit schools target people of color because mm-hmm. they don't necessarily, I mean, it's a huge generalization, but overall don't have that information. And so mm-hmm. they very aggressively target them in the same way that subprime mortgages. You know, we have the evidence now. They were aggressively targeted towards African Americans, even when they could afford more conventional loans, right? I guess my thought was, yes, absolutely, we have privy to more information, but there's also information we don't have or aren't given. Mm-hmm. We are not taught our history. We are taught it as if it's separate. Right. There's history and then there's African-American history in so many ways. Mm-hmm. We can get through graduate school in this country without ever discussing racism. So it's kind of a both end there. Right. We're very uneducated and unaware. And there's a lot of pressure on us when we try to get good information. But then the kind of information that continues to get us ahead, we do have. So both that lack and that extra function to, again, keep our positions protected and intact.
Anastasia.
Yes, a great example that I see of that here in Indianapolis is that there is a sort of newish IPS school. It's the Butler Lab School. And almost every white middle class, upper class family that I know knows about it, is thrilled with the program, hopes to get in through the lottery system. And yet many of the people of color who are the neighbors to the school haven't necessarily heard of the school and how they get priority access. So it's just really interesting to me about how information flows that privileges people with a certain in a certain community, a white economically privileged community, over the people with whom the school in some ways was intentionally hoping to serve. So I think that, you know, one of the things that happens that naturally as human beings is that we share information with people that we know, who we're comfortable with, who we kind of hang out with. And I think one of the things that the work of Robbins that really points to is that white people are not taught how to be interculturally competent. We're not necessarily taught how to communicate in different styles, how to approach conflict differently. You know, what kind of greetings or social customs are most normative in other cultural groups. And that makes white people feel uncomfortable. And when they go like, oh, I don't know exactly what went wrong in that conversation I just had with this black person or that Latino woman, but something wasn't quite right. I just felt uncomfortable, whatever mm-hmm. that uncomfort is. And then we withdraw and we don't share the information that we have. And so I think one of the things that we just need to do as people and as neighbors here in Indianapolis is to learn how to be more interculturally competent so that way we could grow who our sense of the neighbor is and share more opportunities and information that we have.
Stephanie, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for having me. I have two questions. One is, I think that this is a complicated thing, but one is that as I grapple with trying to become woke, as they say, I also struggle with a great deal of guilt for being white, for having that privilege. So that's a question about dealing with white guilt. And then the other question I have is, I'm a mother of a 9-year-old white child, and almost all of her best friends are African American, and I'm delighted by that. But I also, as she grows up and becomes more aware of race, how are there suggestions for how to help her become more interculturally aware?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Stephanie.
Yeah.
Anastasia, I'll start with you.
Well, I'll let Robin talk about white fragility, but I will say that it is what social scientists have shown is that children as young as 2 to 4 years old already process race, and they process that people of different skin tones are treated differently because of those. So it is not too early to start talking about your kids now. Their sense of racial awareness might not be articulate, but it's certainly cognizant. So it's really important to, one, to model how you're engaging with these, and that doesn't have to be perfect modeling. So if you're struggling with that, to share your struggles, to read books that represent different cultures that teach the importance and dignity and power of different voices, and to take them to more community events where the issues that you are really waking up to that are important to you. She could see that share, if it's a daughter, he or she can share how they're important to you, but also important to others. And to really just be honest and teach your child how to be, most of all, just resilient whenever he or she encounters some of that discomfort I was mentioning earlier.
Robin, Anastasia cued you with the phrase white fragility. We probably ought to talk about what white fragility is.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in fairness, guilt, I think, is a really kind of natural response. It's how it functions is kind of be the question, right? So if it's functioning to, prevent you from any further engagement, then I would move it over into the category of white fragility. But to feel guilt at the realization of this, to me, seems to be a natural and maybe even somewhat appropriate response. But again, the key is, what do I do with it? And is it something that motivates me, right? That I am I moving through it, or is it just stopping me and then becoming a kind of indulgence and an excuse not to carry on? And I often say that the antidote to guilt is action, right? Generally, we feel guilty about something is because we haven't done the right thing. We haven't repaired it. And I think so the more you get involved and the more you kind of feel that you're in your integrity through your daily actions and the things you participate in and your responses to things, the less guilt you'll have. I also think when you really understand that this is an inevitable result of being raised in a culture that was founded in white supremacy and continues to be, there really wasn't any way for you not to absorb all kinds of really problematic perspectives and patterns and to have advantage that you may not have chosen. The key is that while it's not your fault, you have to take responsibility for your position and use it to challenge that inequality. To not use it is to, in a sense, be guilty. I have found nothing more empowering, intellectually, emotionally, psychologically stimulating and exciting than this work. Nothing has pushed me up against my learning edge. I could have told you in detail about all the disadvantages I've had, but I never was able to articulate any advantages. And so it's actually really liberating and transformative, but we can't get there from the current paradigm that says to be complicit with racism means you are bad. That is such a perfect setup to have us avoiding the conversation. It's not an either or. It's not a good bad. It's an inevitable result of our society.
We are talking about what it means to be white in America today on No Limits. My guests are Robin DiAngelo. She's an author, consultant, and lecturer on racial and social injustice, and the Reverend Anastasia Zinke of All Souls Unitarian Church. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about what it means to be white in America. My guests are Robin DiAngelo. She's an author, consultant, and lecturer on racial and social injustice, and the Reverend Anastasia Zinke of All Souls Unitarian Church. All Souls is going to be hosting a community conversation on this subject on Saturday from 9 to 4. Cost to attend is $50, and Anastasia, I presume there are still tickets available if people want to get in.
There are on
Eventbrite.com. They are available. We have still a full phone bank worth of calls. So again, I am going to ask our listeners who can join this conversation several ways by sending us an email at nolimitswfyi.org, by finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or doing what a listener named Eddie has done and giving us a call at 866-476-3881 to be tight and succinct in your questions, please, so we can get as many people in as possible. Eddie, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Certainly.
Thank you for having this this topic. I'm Latino, and I live in a very nice neighborhood, and I've been there for about 15 years. And I never knew this about my neighbor, that she's been there for about 10. And right after the election, she started using the Confederate flag, and it almost threw me back. I was raised in Chicago, mm-hmm. and I was taught to be an American, mm-hmm. And somehow the Confederate flag always offended me, because mm-hmm. I understood what it stood for: separation of state, a separation of races, and the history behind it. And for her to justify it, to say that that it's part of her culture, when I asked her what is her culture, she didn't really explain. And she tried to justify it by saying that it's part of her family culture. And I'm like, I was thrown back, because if the family culture is about lynching people and killing people and separation of state and everything else that the Confederate flag stood for, how can you be proud of that? And after about a week of our conversation, she took it down. But it's amazing how now more and more people are using the Confederate flag to justify that it's part of their culture, and I don't understand that.
Thanks very much for the call and for raising this subject. Robin, I'm going to throw that one to you first.
Well, and I'm so sorry to the caller that you have to see that and that you have to experience that. I think it is disingenuous to say that that flag is meant to stand for states' rights. That flag stands for the South under enslavement, pre-civil rights. I don't think you have to scratch very hard. I think it just under the surface is a lot of very deep superiority, resentment. I think that 8 years under Obama was, and I'm going to use a problematic term, but that uppityness mm-hmm. of a black man to be above white people, I think it was intolerable, and I think it caused that just below the surface, kind of that thin veneer of kind of social politics that kept some of that white supremacy in check, erupted. And there's much more permission now to express it, but I think it's always been there, and this current climate has just kind of, again, given more permission for it. But I also want to say that I really don't think white progressives are that much more advanced than, say, this person with the Confederate flag. I think that we are just as difficult for people of color, but in a very different way, because our racism is so denied by us. It's coming from us, And yet we deny that it is. So I don't want a position like that's the extreme racist over there and people who would never fly that flag aren't. Again, our task is to figure out, well, how does my particular form manifest?
Well, and I guess where I would like to take this, because Eddie kind of alluded to this argument you hear, that, oh, when we fly the Confederate flag, this is really just a heritage thing. It's kind of like a walking history lesson rather than we're embracing a certain set of values. You take that to its logical extension. You know, Indiana is the only state in the country where the Klan got control of the state government in the 1920s. Means to do that, we should be flying a white sheet from the top of the state house. How many other kind of coded arguments or disguised arguments are there like that? And I realize the answer is probably going to be infinite, but what are the most pernicious ones? Anastasia, I'll start with you on that one, but I want to hear Robin's thoughts as well.
Well, I'd say that there are certainly a number of conversations that are, when you think about the iceberg, you see the tip, and then there's all the iceberg that's under the water. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there are impolite forms of, I'd say, white supremacy. The Confederate flag, I think, is moving more and more, thankfully, into an impolite form. But there are polite forms. So, for instance, the way that we talk about African Americans being associated with gun crimes or drug crimes, or just talk about people who are incarcerated as blanket bad people instead of people who have made poor choices or people who are human beings that have a possibility for redemption leads us to discount them and marginalize them. And so I think that the way that sometimes we the language we use around criminalization really functions as code for some of our racial discomfort and racialized distribution of power. And so but that's actually kind of polite conversations mm-hmm. to have or to think. And I'm sure Robin has others, but that's the one that I think is most cognizant in my mind these days.
Robin.
I think relating Black Lives Matter to a hate group, I think expressing shock at any crime that occurs in a white suburban neighborhood. It seems to be obligatory that if there's any crime in white suburbia, somebody must be interviewed who says, I can't believe it would happen here, which of course then implies, well, where should it happen? The delusional and irrational resentment over affirmative action, which is a fairly toothless, partial, almost now dismantled program that only ever applied in state and governmental, you know, public organizations. Day in and day out, I'm asked to come into organizations that are overwhelmingly white, particularly at the leadership level, because they're struggling with recruiting and retaining people of color and African Americans in particular. And invariably, some white person is going to bring up affirmative action and how unfair it is. And all of these things imply that people of color, and I don't think there's any person of color that is the ultimate racial other for white people than African Americans. I think we have a particularly deep anti-Black sentiment in the white collective. I think that all of these arguments convey this belief that African Americans are inherently inferior, could not be equal or qualified to us.
We've got a question via Facebook. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. This is from Matthew, who writes, okay, so I realize I'm showing my ignorance with this question. Please help me better understand how white privilege is so much more significant in our culture than pretty people privilege, tall people privilege, and skinny people privilege, or for that matter, any type of privilege. Robin.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to just affirm the way that question was asked, right? that he just said, I might be missing something, but I'd like to hear your thoughts. That is such a, like a basic skill for cross, you know, racial conversations, or even, you know, any conversation about race, rather than kind of coming in with this certitude. Well, all of those forms of privilege exist, and all of them are also mediated by race. So pretty privilege, thin privilege are also going to be greatly amplified if you're also white, because the ultimate signifier of ideal beauty is whiteness. And there are very pretty, very thin African-American models and actresses who can barely get work. And the whiter they are and the closer their features are, then the more likely they may be to get some work. And so I don't think that centering race takes those things off the table, but I don't think you can look at them without also looking at how race intersects.
We're talking about what it means to be white in America today. Jonathan, you're on the air.
I guess it's a question. Do any of the people on your panel even know why you call yourself white? When clearly you're not white. And, you know, and how calling yourself white has a lot to do with racism. And do y'all even know what is behind that?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Jonathan. We'll try to get an answer for you. Yes,
well,
Robin.
I know what's behind it. I know why you call yourself white, but I mean, you know, it seems that a lot of people are oblivious to why they call themselves something that they're not. It's like I'm a man of color.
Mm-hmm.
I'm brown, but I'm labeled black. Mm-hmm. I know why I'm called black, but I had nothing to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
Of, you know, being labeled as black, and it has everything to do with racism. So I'm listening, and they're like, well, I'm white, you're pink. You're a pinkish peach color, but, you know, calling yourself white in itself is saying, like, I'm superior and I'm better than others. And that was the whole reason, you know, for doing so. And I'm listening to you, you know, say that, and I've always been baffled why folks, you know, as a kid, why would they call themselves something that they're not? And as I got older and I did research, I found out, you know, the whole point was to call themselves was to separate themselves from others, you know, to create a class. So I think part of the problem is that you call yourself something that historically, you know, was meant to say that you are better than those that do not look like you.
Thanks very much for the call, Jonathan. Robin.
Well, I think it speaks to the socially constructed nature of race, right? It's made up. It's powerful in its consequences, but it is a social construction. And for me to call myself white in the context of being honest about what I have been taught and what I have internalized is very different than just calling myself white with no critical awareness. And so I'm trying to actually expose that socially constructed nature of it, and to admit to what it means and how it shapes us in a way is to break with it, right? To try to expose the lie of it. Until we get to a place where the way we think of ourselves is just based on, my skin is pink and that's all it is, and yours is brown and that's all it is. But given that we're not in that society, that context, then we need to expose the lie of race.
Well, and I guess I want to get to what I saw was Jonathan's point, too, that to some degree, you know, we associate the word white with purity, with blamelessness, with all of that. You know, we talk about the black arts, the dark arts, and those are supposed to be sinister. There's a connotation of evil. So we're making moral judgments as well about people based on their their skin tone. Anastasia, I see you nodding your head. So,
you know, it was really interesting for me to learn some of the history about how white identity was constructed. And one really powerful visual identity was from Ford. What he would do, he would actually have these English schools where he would take European immigrants, bring them in, teach them English, and he would do this graduation ceremony where they would go in to a physical, like, melting pot, wearing their ethnic European clothes, and they'd come out all in this uniform dress, and he'd call them white. So white has been constructed. It is how, and I use the term really as an indicator of the privilege, the racial white privilege that has been given to me and that is apparent on my skin and gets awarded to me as I move about the world. But I think by leaning into this work, I don't let it become my functional identity. The functional identity that I try to embrace is as an anti-racist person, which I think we could be no matter what our skin color looks like. And I think it's really important to recognize kind of the difference of kind of the functional role that we inherit by the way we look in our country and the identity role of how we intentionally and consciously try to move into the world.
Yeah, can I add to that?
Yes,
I mean,
Robin.
And I really appreciate, I think what John's point about the caller's point, there's really no way out, right? Like the language itself reinforces these very deep kind of under the surface of the water iceberg elements of white as inherently innocent and black as, you know, inherently evil, right? That is happening. And there's really no clean space outside of these constructs. So yes, it reinforces that. And to use it in the way Anastasia is talking about, and I hope I am too, to be honest about what it means and the injustice of that is to interrupt those aspects that say it's inherently good or innocent. But because I know my people really well, so I kind of know the white collective, both being a member of it and from years of trying to work with white people on this, I also worry that white people will take the point the caller just made and use it to shift over to, yeah, see, we shouldn't call ourselves white. We're just human, right? Yeah. And then it shifts over.
And everyone else isn't. Yeah, everyone else isn't at that point. Yeah. Yeah, it shows, and we're almost out of time here. So I'm going to ask Anastasia real quickly again to talk about if people want to continue this conversation at All Souls, how they can go about doing that.
So you want to go to eventbrite.com and search Robin DiAngelo, and you'll be able to find tickets to purchase online. They're $50. And again, the event is Saturday from 9 to 4.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guest, Robin DiAngelo, and the Reverend Anastasia Zinke for what's been a provocative conversation. I'd like to thank all of our listeners, particularly those who called in and sent questions through other media. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you. We hope you'll come back on Thursday. We're going to be diving into the Nickel Plate Railroad controversy. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's Public Broadcasting Stations.